This episode contains descriptions of child sex abuse. Listener discretion is advised.
In the 1990s, the trials and story of Eric and Lyle Menendez captivated the country. The brothers convicted of murdering their parents, Jose and Kitty.
The jury recommended life in prison without parole for gunning down their parents.
In the deciding trial, all testimony of sexual abuse was deemed inadmissible, the judge citing irrelevance. But now for the first time, another alleged victim of Jose Menendez is coming forward with accusations of sexual abuse. And it could mean a chance at freedom for the Menendez brothers.
It's time for the world to know the truth.
In a new docuseries called Menendez Menudo Boys Betrayed, former Menudo band member Roy Rosello says he was molested by then-head of RCA Records, Jose Menendez.
I know what he did to me in his house.
Rosello performed with the iconic Puerto Rican boy band from the age of 13 to 16. The group, known for giving Ricky Martin his start, was formed and managed by Edgardo Diaz. Rosello says Diaz also sexually abused him, and at one point brought him to Menendez's New Jersey home, where he says Menendez drugged and raped him.
That's the man here that raped me. This guy, that's the pedophile.
How old were you there?
14 years old.
Journalists Neri Inclán and Robert Rand made the connection between Rosello and Menendez while working on another story.
He's also this key witness in this other spectacular crime.
Rand delivered the news to the brothers, who are currently serving life sentences without parole for their crimes.
We have found somebody who we believe was abused by your father.
Okay.
How do you feel about that?
Frankly, to be honest, I feel horrible.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm a casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve these crimes. And with me today is...
Hi, I'm Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer producer of Criminal Minds.
And I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service and host of the podcast Crime Analyst, and a reader of all things crime related, specifically over this last weekend, Robert Rand's book. I've been so fixated by this case, Jim and Lisa. There's just so much I didn't know about it. And the more layers you peel back, the more, like I said to you, angry I feel about this case, particularly as there's such a false narrative out there, and people just seem to cling to that false narrative and aren't prepared to open their minds to the fact that actually the boys may well have been framed in a certain way for a political reason, for a particular reason.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. And certainly I heard it during the second trial. I heard the words abuse excuse repeatedly. And not knowing and not having sat through the first trial, I didn't know what that trivialized evidence, and I'm using air quotes just because people shouldn't think that I'm saying that I agree with that characterization. I disagree with that characterization completely, but they trivialized evidence of hundreds or thousands of sex crimes committed against the two of them. I mean, it's unbelievable to call that trivial. And for a prosecutor to say that, and for a judge to say that, and to keep that evidence out, I think, is a miscarriage of justice. And because of that, I think they deserve a new trial. And I know that there's a lot of people who don't want them to get a new trial, but this, we should talk a little bit about Roy and about the evidence that he can give. And they have to make a record. There is a possibility that there's a different outcome, but I'm kind of putting the cart before the horse. So let's talk about Roy and what he came forward to say, and then the other evidence, the other new evidence that was not available at the time that should have been available, right, Laura?
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is some of the messages and questions that I've received when I've posted a little video about this particular case. Things like, well, I believe that the boys just made up the abuse because of the trial. But what the new evidence shows is that there were disclosures before. And I want to make that very clear, because it doesn't seem to be, you can say this so many ways and people just don't seem to acknowledge that there were disclosures beforehand. And some of those disclosures were not put before the court. And one of those key pieces of evidence was a letter. I mentioned it in our last episode, that Eric had written to his cousin, Andy Kano, and he had described, well, I want to read to our listeners exactly what he wrote. I'm just going to read one paragraph. I've been trying to avoid Dad. It's still happening, Andy, but it's worse for me now. I can't explain it. He's so overweight that I can't stand to see him. I never know when it's going to happen, and it's driving me crazy. Every night I stay up thinking he might come in. I need to put it out of my mind. I know what you said before, but I'm afraid. You just don't know Dad like I do. He's crazy. He's warned me 100 times about telling anyone, especially Lyle. Am I a serious wimpus? I don't know if I'll make it through this. I can handle it, Andy. I need to stop thinking about it. Now, that letter was found in Andy's possession. Now, he unfortunately died, and it's seemingly he died, took too many sleeping pills, and he died because of that. But actually, Eric had told him an awful lot about what had been going on. And I believe that Andy was psychologically burdened and tortured by what he knew. So I can't say whether that, yeah, it's possible. I don't know whether that was a suicide or whether he genuinely did take those pills, but it's a big burden for someone to bear, a secret, because Andy was told by Eric, please don't tell anybody else. And he had told him a lot about what was going on. But because this letter was written just months before Eric and Lyle killed their parents, this is now very key evidence. And
critical evidence.
Andy's mother asked Robert Rand to meet with her, and she handed over this letter to him. And Robert read it and then passed it on to Cliff. And Cliff, the lawyer, spoke with Leslie and the whole team to ask whether they had ever seen this letter before, and nobody had. So this letter was not used in the trial, but in my opinion, it does talk to the disclosure that abuse was still going on. He said, you don't know Dad like I do. He's crazy. I'm afraid. He talked about telling Lyle and that he'd been warned 100 times, and he didn't know whether he could handle it or carry on with this. And, you know, part of it to me makes me wonder, was he contemplating suicide, which we see with a lot of child abuse victims, and certainly child sex abuse victims, where they turn it inwardly. But this letter to me is key evidence, and that has been put together as part of the habeas that's now been filed, along with Roy's testimony, the allegations that he was also raped by Jose Menendez, which talks to the fact that he had abused other boys, and therefore that abuse is important for the judge and the court to hear about.
Absolutely.
Have they served 33 years now, which if it were a manslaughter case, they would have been out by now. And so I would imagine that the request is for their conviction to be vacated, for them to be released, or at the very least, a new trial. But a third trial just seems unbelievable for them to have to go through a third trial.
I know what you're saying, Laura, and I agree. It's going to be a lot, and it's possible that the prosecution will relent and just withdraw the charges and let them go, basically. But basically, let's talk about habeas. So habeas petition, habeas corpus, literally means bring the body, you know, or the person, right? That it's somebody who's in custody that they're going to bring before the court. So typically, there are a number of appeals, and the appeals in this case, I'm sure, have been exhausted. And the only way to get anything new, any further court to look at this, is to prove up that they have new evidence, like the letter you just read. Now, this is a letter, as you said, that predated the murders. This completely and utterly destroys any argument that they made this up for the trial. This preceded any planning. This preceded any actions that they took towards getting even with their parents or stopping their parents from killing them, whatever it is. But it is so that is critical evidence. The other critical evidence is
evidence that proves, that corroborates the fact that Jose was a child sex offender, that he was raping boys, when another boy, totally unrelated to these two, completely and totally on his own, comes forward and says that Jose Menendez raped me along with Edgardo Diaz. That is excellent corroborative evidence of the Menendez brothers' defense. Although it's imperfect self-defense, it is a self-defense argument, and they should have been allowed to put forth all of the evidence they had. And to say that it's the judge saying it's repetitive or trivial, and the prosecutor characterizing it as trivial, and then the prosecutor saying, you heard no evidence of sexual abuse because the prosecutor kept it out, but he used that in his argument to the jury. No wonder they convicted him of murder. They didn't have the evidence that was present at the time, and they certainly didn't have this new evidence that nobody knew about at the time. Nobody but Eric, but clearly he was not allowed to put any of that evidence in. And so in the habeas process, there are many, many pitfalls. Let me put it that way. So somebody has to make a determination that this new evidence is credible. And how is that done? Well, testimony from Roy, the new witness, and verification of the chain of custody of that letter. Those two things are going to be critical evidence in terms of proving that one, it predates the murders, and two, that Roy had no connection to the Menendez brothers, had no way of knowing them or having any insight into what they said. And obviously, anything that he did in terms of speaking about it when it was going on, in terms of going to the doctor, in terms of anything that could be used to help contemporaneously verify that it happened way back in the day. Also, any other members of Menudo, any other people who tried out for Menudo who were victimized by Edgardo Diaz, that also is good corroborative evidence, because even though they may not have a claim against Jose Menendez, if they did get molested or raped or abused by the manager of Menudo and in their connection to Menudo, then that, again, that's a secondary way to corroborate what happened to the Menendez brothers. So all of that information should come out.
So what do you think might happen, Jim?
Well, Laura, I think that the district attorney's office, well, first of all, the LAPD should assign the case to somebody in special victims. This is a sex crimes case, and it is a very, well, high level one, and it should be handled by experts in this particular field. So once that is done, they should interview Roy. They should interview all of his family members, his friends at the time, other members of Menudo. They should do a comprehensive investigation to try to determine if they can find other witnesses, other victims, and other evidence that will corroborate what Roy has said. Once they do that, they should present it to the district attorney's office. The district attorney should convene a grand jury. And a grand jury is, it's a group, usually somewhere between 30 and 40 members of the public, just like from the regular jury pool, who have to commit to a certain period of time where this grand jury is going to be open. And during that time period, they could hear evidence from multiple cases. And as the evidence of an investigation comes in, they can hear this over time. They'll reconvene over and over again. And then at the end of that evidence, the district attorney will basically present them with charges that they should review. And if they find that the charges have been proven, then they call it a true bill. And that means that they are then handing down an indictment. They want to indict the person that is the target of that grand jury investigation or persons. And if they don't feel that the case has been proven, then they hand down a no true bill and the case is then dropped. There's no opportunity for the prosecutor to bring charges. And many times in heavily politicized cases, they'll use a grand jury because it sort of takes the onus off of the DA's office. Well, the grand jury spoke. And, you know, you and I know very intimately a case that happened out in Boulder, Colorado, in which the grand jury voted to indict two people for first degree murder. And the prosecutor came out and said the grand jury has spoken and there will be no charges filed. What he didn't say is the grand jury voted to indict those two people. Unbelievable. Just completely misled the public into thinking that the grand jury voted a no true bill when they definitely voted a true bill. So let's hope that kind of what I think is very, very illegal behavior. Let's hope that doesn't happen here. Let's hope that the LAPD does their job. I know there's amazing investigators, especially I know there are amazing investigators in the Special Victims Unit, and they should complete this investigation. It's going to take some time because many of the witnesses are of course, going to be overseas in Puerto Rico and elsewhere. And so it could take quite a bit of time. And then a grand jury. District attorneys can present to the grand jury for days, weeks, months, sometimes even years. I don't think this is a years, but I wouldn't be surprised if it went on up to a year. So we're not going to hear anything in this case for a number of months, I believe, Laura. And I think that people are going to be antsy about it. And of course, the Menendez brothers are going to be antsy about it. And Roy is going to be antsy about it because they want to see justice done. And if the case that Roy brings does result in Edgardo Diaz being extradited from Puerto Rico, arrested here and indicted here, I believe that the momentum that's caused by that will actually push forward somebody to act in the Menendez case. All the Menendez attorneys can do right now is file a habeas corpus petition based on the new evidence they have and the new witness that they have. And they may be adjoined from raising the issues that the court did not allow this evidence in the second trial.
I have two questions about Roy's case, and I don't think it was clarified in the Peacock documentary. Why is Roy Rosello, formerly of Menudo, bringing this case to L.A. and not to New York, where he alleges Jose Menendez raped him?
Well, I'll take the first part of that, because there were many offenses here. You remember that he recalled the Biltmore when they were at the hotel, and Roy and one of his other Menudo band members had girls in their room, and Diaz found out. And he then put Roy into the bathroom naked through the night and whipped him with a towel and then raped him, sodomized him, and said that it was for punishment. So Roy says specifically there were a lot of offenses here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was interesting too, Lisa, because I'm sure there's multiple places, given that they were on tours and right. so forth, of, you know, why choose LA when there were multiple other places where he talked about the abuse, and actually very serious abuse as well, which Jim and Lisa talks to Diaz being sadistic again and that power and control dynamic. Mm. But I am curious about, you know, whether you believe, Jim, will he be extradited? Let's say that charges are filed in Los Angeles. Will he then be extradited and have to stand trial here in Los Angeles? Or do you think that they will explore other areas, I mean, geographically, where he abused and raped and trafficked some of the boys?
Well, this is a perfect case that could be brought in the federal courts because of the interstate. And I guess Puerto Rico is still looked at as a possession of the United States, but it is overseas. So this is a perfect case for a federal court, but that doesn't take away jurisdiction from any of the states where the crimes occurred. You can be prosecuted both federally for all of the crimes, as well as individually for any crimes that occurred in any of the states. So that's not double jeopardy in the United States. So I believe that he came to LA because this is the place where Diaz and Menendez acted together to rape him. And that is a critical connection also to the Menendez brothers' trial. So I believe that it was a benefit to the Menendez brothers for him to file these charges in Los Angeles. And he may have done that. His lawyers may have decided to do that in cooperation with Menendez's lawyers, because that brings it to the forefront in front of the same court that handled the Menendez brothers' case. So I do believe there was some method to this madness, and not that he couldn't go to every jurisdiction. Of course he could do that. He could file charges in every one of those jurisdictions, but obviously the statute of limitations may have run in the case of Diaz, in the case of Menendez. So that means the only time he could actually give testimony would be before a grand jury or in a third trial for the Menendez brothers.
Yes, I think that's a very interesting point, actually. And we mustn't forget they acted in tandem. So you had Diaz creating the perfect grooming an opportunity with the boys. And I know you and Lisa talked about that before, if they have to be 16, but actually they were 12, some of them, 12, 13, 14. And we know Roy was 13.
Yeah, they got kicked out when they were 16.
Yeah, so he created this perfect grooming environment and the pool parties, etc. But Roy was actually targeted in a different way. He was seen outside of Diaz's office and he was chosen. He didn't audition. And I think that's a very interesting point because of everything that happened thereafter. And I mean that he was asked to go to Diaz's house and he was flattered by that, but he was quite a shy boy. He was quite vulnerable, I would say, and malleable. And Diaz tested his boundaries. As we know, Jim and Lisa, happens with perpetrators who target, they want vulnerable, malleable boys. And he told him that he would have to do things. And then he raped him on that first occasion. And I want to make it clear, because I know you talked about his mother being in the home address, and she obviously knew what he was doing. And that to me is incredibly egregious. There's a point of intervention and him being caught. But also the fact that when the contract was going to be signed and Diaz went to Roy's home address, the thing that really stood out to me was Roy was hiding in the closet, shaking and terrified. So it's another learning point for our listeners. If your child is acting in a way that is the opposite of what they should be doing, i.e. he wasn't jumping for joy, he was terrified. Ask questions about that. You know, and it is important we talk about intervention and prevention, because the other boys, you'll recall Roy saying they didn't accept him into the Menudo band because he hadn't auditioned and he was seen as the special chosen boy, that he was in this relationship with Diaz. The word isn't relationship.
No.
He was being abused. So again, it's another learning point.
Yeah.
That it's very isolating for an abuse victim. That he was being sort of isolated and locked down in all directions, that the boys didn't accept him because he was seen as, you know, the favorite. So he couldn't talk to them about what was happening. But it wasn't his choice to be targeted. And I just think to those calls when he was saying to his mother, I want to die. I hate it here. I want to die. I want to kill myself. I don't want to be here. And his own mother isn't hearing him. And obviously he's interested in the money. But I mean, seriously, you might not be able to afford to go on those trips with your son. But when a child is telling you that A, they don't want to go, and B, that they want to kill themselves, they're warning signs.
And fact
that it wasn't taken seriously, that just breaks my heart. Yeah. And how sadistic he was, but he knew, Diaz knew what he was doing, because we saw in the documentary Roy speaking to his former band members and sort of being quite apprehensive about how they might feel towards him, as if he was the problem. Yeah, and yeah. I think so often abuse victims feel that they're the problem rather than it being turned on its head, and it's because of people's reactions, isn't it? And the account where he spoke to Ash Ruiz, you know, the guy in the hat who said that he was in his shower one day in, you know, they were on tour, and then suddenly he felt a presence and he felt someone was in the shower room and he felt a body next to him and he turned around and it was Diaz, and he confronted him and challenged him and said, get off of me. I will expose you. The band does not mean that much to me. I will tell everyone, don't you dare touch me ever again. And that was enough to stop him. He didn't touch Ash ever again. That tells us he knew what he was doing and he was targeting specific boys. And Roy was definitely, from what I could see, that vulnerable. Remember that right. clip where the cameras came to him and he was meant to say something to camera and he just froze. And he was like a deer in the headlights, these big eyes.
Yes.
And he just didn't know what to say. That told me about his character and how soft and vulnerable and sweet he was, that he wasn't wanting to be out there, the big I am. He was had a lot of humility about him, but vulnerability. And I could see why Diaz chose him and repeatedly abused him and in every way kept him quiet. And I could see Roy listening to Ash and thinking, what if I just told him to stop? That would have ended it. And there again, he thinks it's him.
I hate that he would take on that it's his fault. He should have fought harder because he probably did fight back. You know, I don't want the message to be that, oh, he should have done something different and this would have had a different outcome.
But every victim, I mean, that's the insidious nature of being sexually victimized as a child. It's like every victim takes on the blame. Every victim takes on the shame. No victim feels like they were completely and utterly not responsible for it. They feel a sense of responsibility. And as they age, that can be exacerbated because they're getting older and older and older, and they're thinking with their older brain about what they didn't do when they were a child. They didn't realize the situation, and you can't erase the learning that you have over these years. So I feel like I'm glad that Roy came forward, and I hope that this whole process is going to be restorative for him, that he understands that he has so much self-worth and he's a hero for coming forward, and he's going to help not only himself but generations of other boys who have gone through this or may go through this. And hopefully this discussion that we're having will educate people so that when they see these signs, like Laura said, these are huge red flag warning signs. You don't ignore them. There's a reason why your son is saying, I want to die. I hate it here. There's something going on. And putting him in a safe environment where he feels he can tell what's going on and do something about it, that's what should be done.
And for people to step up when you see something going on, which, you know, it's very interesting from that docuseries, just how many people knew, both in the Menendez case, but also in Roy's case, that Diaz always had a boy in his penthouse or in his room. Why weren't people asking questions about that? It wasn't that he was hard up financially. There was no reason for a boy to be in his room. And the fact that the boys, just on that last point, you can be made to feel special. You know, the chosen one, if you desperately want to be in the band or whatever it is, and that offender's using that as leverage. And I do think with Diaz, you know, no one really knew him. He didn't have adult friends, very much like Jimmy Savile, kept himself to himself. Yeah, just the mirrors of some of these perpetrators, that people don't really know who the abusers are. And actually, why I was holding that example up with Roy and Ash was that it tells me how manipulative and how good Diaz, or how devious he was, I should say, in being able to read the boys' temperatures and use that leverage for each of them. And I in no way blame Roy, but right. I think that, you know, it compounds the shame and everything that goes with it, where boys are much more likely to push their emotions down and sit in that shame and try and deal with it rather than talk out about what happened. And you can see with Roy that kind of journey he's been on, just in the documentary, of feeling empowered. But I do worry he thinks the criminal justice system might be the answer, because we know on the other side with Menendez and all the other cases, it's not necessarily the thing that you need it to be. So there's a big journey ahead, isn't there, for both, well, the Menendez boys and for Roy. And I was very glad to hear that somebody had said, no, you must not meet, in that documentary, that they must keep this corridor between Roy and the Menendez men, because there can't be any interference. Right. And so, you know, that was a bit worrying when I heard Robert Rand suggest that they should meet for the legal point, right? Mm-hmm. They must not, actually, because you have to preserve Roy's testimony and evidence. But what's Roy's testimony and evidence we heard that he said Jose Diaz fed him into Jose Menendez, and then Jose opened this fine bottle of wine and coercively got him to drink it. He drugged him first, Roy. And I think that's interesting because a lot of people think that a perpetrator might do one thing all the time. And actually what we know is that they don't do that. And perhaps because he didn't know Roy, he used alcohol. And how many other boys are there that he did that to subdue them, to ensure that they wouldn't remember? It's a form of control. But he already had control over Eric and Lyle. He didn't need to. Drug them. And I think that's an important distinction because perpetrators will use other tools and ruses and ways. But Diaz and Menendez sounded like they were in cahoots.
But how does that happen? That's my that's one of my questions, Jim and Laura. How do these two fucking shit stains for human beings recognize that in each other?
Oh, I mean, come is on. There a, I think Diaz was so outwardly.
But how
obvious.
Does that go down? I mean, you're in a meeting with Jose Menendez and it's like, hey, do you want to fuck my boy band? I mean, how does that literally happen?
Well, I would think that it was Jose who made the overture because he would be the one that would be less obvious because his other victims were inside his family. But, you know, I'm sure that he saw and asked for access and Edgardo was very happy to have found somebody else who thinks and acts the same way and was probably, you know, asking for favors for the band and getting more money from the recording company and all that kind of stuff. He was probably providing the boys. It's sex trafficking. And he was probably getting paid back from Jose through whatever recording contract they had.
I just don't know how you test that boundary. Like, how do you sort of imply it and then...
Are you kidding me?
I don't know. I guess I don't think that way.
If they're together with the boy, I think it would be very obvious what they felt about the boys. And he probably couldn't help himself lusting after those boys that were in the room with him. So another offender would see that and recognize it for what it is, and they would feel very safe talking to each other about it.
Jim just hit the nail on the head for me. You know, it's the nod, it's the wink. Roy said that when he walked in and Jose Menendez saw him, his eyes wanted to devour him. He knew that Jose Menendez saw him as someone sexually to be attracted to. So how does he know that and others not see it in the room? We all see it. Mm-hmm. We might not choose to acknowledge it, but we do see it. I've been in rooms where I've seen that. And it's sure. Over time, it can be subtle, but the power play of them scratching each other's backs, of, you know, it being reciprocal of what one gets from the other. And bearing in mind, we know Jose Menendez liked to be the powerful man who, you know, made other people feel small and other people wanted to appease him and make him happy. But it is disgusting, Lisa. You know, if you don't operate on that level, particularly on the fact these are young boys, that they think that this is the best opportunity of their life, right?
Mm-hmm.
When, as Roy said, it was the best and the worst. And I think oftentimes that's what the offender relies on. It's the best and the worst. And you take the best, you suppress the worst, because you don't want to be seen as a failure or let your mother down or stop that money coming in. All those pressures that were on Roy, who was just a kid.
And I can tell you that children in entertainment, I may have mentioned this before, those who succeed, they're called adult pleasers. And that's a terrible term. It's very valuable on set, because if I say, go there, sit in that chair, say that line, do it again, cry, come back. And the child wants to perform. They want to please the adult, as opposed to my children, who would be like, why do you want me to do that? Like, they would be pushing against that authority constantly. But I can see that in Roy, that he just wanted to do the right thing. He just wanted to do his job and please these adults who his mother had hand-delivered him to.
Which under normal circumstances would be fine, but when you are under the control of two psychopaths, and I do believe there's psychopathy there in both of them, you know, to be able to turn up at one of the Menudo boys' funerals, bold as brass, and act as if nothing had happened, that takes an awful lot of front to do that. I'm talking about Diaz.
Think about it. Remember, we were always talking about target-rich environments. Well, there's a lot of other boy bands around the world, and those are also target-rich environments. And everybody around those bands should be opening their eyes and being careful to make sure that those boys are not being taken advantage of. I mean, they travel around the world and they're brought around all these rich and famous people and they have all this attention. And there are people, I can guarantee you, in their circle who are there because they want access to those boys. And so just like in Menudo and just like in other bands like this, any kind of youth serving organization is going to attract offenders. Maybe one, but probably more likely more than one. And so we're calling out to the responsible adults around these children to make sure that they're providing a safe environment for these boys or girls, and they're making sure that they are not being taken advantage of.
There was a not so subtle shout out. I'm sure you both perceived this in the Peacock documentary where I forget who said it, but if some famous victim came forward, this could really help Roy's case. Mm. I'm not going to say who I think they mean, but I think there are some high, high profile people who could have, who were victimized as well by Diaz, who could come forward and perhaps really, really make a huge difference.
Yeah, well, I hope that person has gotten to the place where he can talk openly about it. And I hope that that happens and that that will encourage other people to come forward. I did it. It's difficult. I know how difficult it is. And I've spoken in many states and in a number of countries about what happened to me. It's not something that I wanted to do. It's not something that I found easy. But I do know that one of my driving forces was to try to help other people so that they wouldn't have to go through the same thing, or so that people understood that this happens and how it happens. And it doesn't just happen to somebody else. It can happen to your kids. It can happen to your friends. It can happen to your loved ones. Be on the alert for it. And make sure that when you see things, that you provide a non-judgmental, non-emotional, not blowing up atmosphere so that they can feel safe to disclose. And they won't necessarily disclose all at once. They'll test the waters. And then over time, if they feel like they're being heard and there's actually an opportunity to do something about it, then they'll come forward. Wouldn't it be great if every child who was being groomed was able to talk to adults who are responsible and not offenders and was able to prevent them from being victimized? And if they have been victimized, if they could come forward and talk without being stigmatized, because those are things, those are the two of the most horrific things that our society does. It stigmatizes victimization and it gives victims the belief that they will never be seen as a whole person again. Well, we're here to tell you that's just not the case. You're a whole person, you deserve justice, and the justice system is obligated to give it to you.
Well said, Jim. I hope in both these cases, we do hear much more about the positive outcome, because I do believe that the Menendez boys, now men, should be out of prison. Yeah. I just do. And no one's going to persuade me otherwise. They've served 33 years. There's enough evidence to show that they were abused horrifically. And when they confided in their mother, she said to them that they had ruined their family. And she said that she knew. And she also said, which was very important, no one ever helped me. No one ever protected me. It goes full circle. That to me answers the question of why she didn't do anything. And when she wasn't being abused and the boys were, that gave her breathing space. And she felt Jose was obsessed with the boys. I'm not saying any of these things are right, but to understand the psychology, to understand.
It makes us understand. Yeah.
Decisions
how it
that two boys took. They're not going to be the same decisions that others might take.
Right.
But everyone's situation is different. And Eric had Lyle. There were two brothers in this situation, and they felt that there would never be any escape. And what Robert Rand was also told about when he received the letter to Andy Carno was that there was an application form to Brown University, a full tennis scholarship, fully filled out, that Jose Menendez had shoved in the bottom drawer. He didn't send that application off. Eric knew that he was trapped and there was no way out. How did he know that? Well, every door had shut. Lyle was off doing his thing. But for Eric, Jose had said to his sister, he needs extra tuition. I need to supervise him. I'm keeping him home. He needs me and he needs me to supervise. These things that are said that may not make it into a trial, but for Eric, the doors closed. And for him, there was no way out. So to live a lifetime of abuse and not know there would ever be an end to it. We have to step ourselves into someone's shoes, a child. He was 17 at the time, turned 18, still a young boy, man, and he was the one that was still being sexually abused. So to the people who've written to me to say there was no evidence of abuse and that he wasn't being sexually abused.
That's bullshit.
It's bullshit, yeah. And I'm fed up with dealing with the lies and the non-facts. If we go back to the actual facts of the case, and that's what we've been discussing on Real Crime Profile, and it may be very different from how other people have discussed the case, but Jim and I are experts in this, and it is time that we saw change. And right, the Menendez boys, there's evidence that needs to be fully assessed. And I don't know what the full conclusion or outcome might be, but Roy and all the other victims, because there will be hundreds.
Yes.
They will all be on a different journey. But those who feel they can speak out, I really hope that they do.
Me
because
too.
Diaz is still out there. We have to remember that. He's still out there unchecked and not held accountable for his actions and his decisions and for all the lives that he's ruined. And there needs to be justice and he needs to be held to account for his behavior.
Right. And just one tweak on that, the lives that he has caused tremendous amounts of pain and suffering in, but your life is not over. You can have a wonderful life if you can address it, if you can come forward and speak to somebody who can, you know, so who can provide you with support and understanding and therapy. Those things can help you so that your life is not ruined. And before, Laura, you said that the doors had closed on the Menendez brothers, especially Eric. Those were prison bars. That's what was closed on him. It wasn't just like somebody closed the door and he's going to be locked out of somewhere or locked in somewhere. He's in a prison with his father who is raping him repeatedly. He can't sleep at night without fearing that his father is coming in again and again and again. And we know that from his own words long before he ever formed the idea of buying a shotgun and killing his father so that he could gain freedom. That is proof, that is evidence that not only did the sexual abuse and rape happen, but that it is what drove his actions and his brother's actions. And it was had nothing to do with greed or any other kind of negative motivation. He literally wanted to stop being raped. I can understand that. I can absolutely understand that. And I believe that our listeners should be able to as well.
Well said. And I'll only add in that there was torture as well. And when you're tortured over time, and coercive control is akin to that, when someone understands all your biggest fears and what hurts you. And that's what Jose Menendez did to his boys, and more specifically to Eric. And he had him hostage, and it was invisible chains that kept him there. And I hope that in our And it looked like it was never going to end. Now, if you put yourself in that situation, you can start to empathize and understand the decisions. You might choose to believe that they are the wrong decisions, and that's absolutely okay. Everybody has their own opinion, but there is a justice system that has a manslaughter offense and murder. And what the boys were judged on, in my opinion, was only part of the story. And the storytelling is very important. It wasn't just part of the story, but the prosecutors lied. And that's something that I find incredibly difficult to reconcile. And I think a lot of our listeners, if you're listening to the facts of the case, you will find the same. And it's when you were believed, when you were listened to as a victim, that you start to heal. So we all have that power to give to somebody, to listen and not judge, to help them heal. And that's a really important first step for anybody. We've heard from hundreds of victims all across the world who've said they've listened to us talk and they have then articulated what happened to them.
Yeah. It happens every time I speak in public.
Yes, and me too. So that tells us that there's power in these conversations. And there's so much more that I could say. I have to say, I was just raging all across the weekend with this case and trying to figure out the decision-making in it and, you know, and coming to just this determination that this is just such a gross miscarriage of justice and that it has to be put right. And I mean that in terms of the next steps. Nothing's ever going to give their life back to Eric and Lyle. That won't happen. But for Roy and for all the other boys, of having their day in court and having their voices heard, there's a lot of power in that. So I'm going to be very intrigued to follow this case. I know our listeners will as well. We've covered it in much more depth than what we anticipated. We didn't know what we were going to get with the Peacock documentary. And it's been a really important case, I think, for us on Real Crime Profile, which is why Absolutely. We spent so much time discussing the detail of it, the actual facts and the evidence.
So if you haven't already, please go out and read Robert Rand's incredible book, The Menendez Murders. I know that, you know, it was just, it's very, very eye-opening. And also to know that victims don't have to be perfect, right? He very objectively details the brothers' pre-offense and post-offense actions very objectively. But it's a really great read if you want to know the real story.
And we want to thank all of our listeners for spending the time to listen, but also for actually caring to weigh in. And we love hearing from people. And look, you're allowed to have a dissenting opinion. We get it. But we do this for a living. We are professionals in the field. And because of that, we have very specific reasons for our professional opinions. And you can discount them if you'd like, but these are the firm beliefs that Laura and I came to totally separately. We don't get together and agree what we're going to say on the air. Sometimes we do look at things differently, but in this case, we're 100% rock solid on the side of the fact that the Menendez brothers were sexually victimized and raped by their father for a long time, over a decade. And that has real psychological and emotional and physical ramifications on them as victims. And they made their decisions, and they have to suffer the consequences of those decisions. But they were based on horrific crimes that were repeatedly committed against them. It is not just one act that they suffered. They suffered repeatedly, and every single night they worried that it was going to happen again, and they had no control over it. They had nowhere to go for help, especially Eric. So understand that before you condemn them. But we want to thank you for listening. And if this triggered anybody, please take care of yourself. Talk to somebody, get some help, get therapy. We want you to have a good life too. Until next time, this is Real Crime Profile, signing off.
If you like listening to our show and appreciate the work that Jim and Laura do and their expertise, you can do us a big favor. Please head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our pod and leave us a 5-star rating and write your thoughts about why you enjoy our show. It really, really is important and helps other people find us. Also, did you know that you can share our episode? It is so easy. On the Apple Podcast app, click the 3 dots drop-down menu and you'll see an option to share to your socials or to a particular person, and then they can hear for themselves why you love listening to Real Crime Profile. Thank you so much for your support.
Real Crime Profile was created by Jim Clementi, Laura Richards, and Lisa Zambetti. Produced by Laura Richards, Lisa Zambetti, Jim Clementi, and XG Productions, and distributed by Wondery. Editing by Nick Jaworski at Podcast Monster. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba.